Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are going to talk about any number of things today, many things today. In the course of this hour, we're joined, of course, in studio on Mondays here, my co-host Anthony McCarthy.
Great to be here, Mark. Busy weekend, but boy, we have a lot of stuff to talk about this
we
hour.
Do.
It's exciting, actually.
And reminding you all that Anthony McCarthy is here. His show is on every Friday at 5 to 7 p.m. in this time slot, and both shows are productions of the Center for Emerging Media. So we're colleagues in many ways here, which is a good thing. We are joined today by a number of guests during the course of the next 2 hours. But first, we're going to start with a conversation with Russ Baker, who joined us last summer. The book he wrote was Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. That show got many comments, and people really kind of took to that book because it raised issues about Nixon's White House that had not been raised anywhere else. And he's written a piece at Truthout called What Obama is Up Against, which was a piece looking at President Obama's a year after his election, and came up with a perspective we haven't read in very many other places. So he sent us his piece. We asked him to come on, and we also asked Sam Faddis to come on. Sam Faddis is a retired CIA operations officer, wrote about his experiences in a book called Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq that he helped run. And that's where we met him, so when the book came out, and Sam joins us in the studio. Russ Baker, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, and Sam, good to have you back in the studio.
Good to be here.
So, gentlemen, let's launch into this. I wish you would start it with Russ, if you just kind of outline, especially your thesis about the role that the military and intelligence agencies that play inside the White House and federal government that we don't often think about in terms of how it affects the power of a presidency.
Sure. Well, as you know, the I don't want to say the thesis of Family of Secrets, because it's mostly a collection of an awful lot of facts that I uncovered in 5 years of research. But the central point is that we focus too much on presidents as single actors upon the stage of history, neglecting to properly examine the institutional imperatives and internal values of entities like the U.S. military and the intelligence community. I'm not claiming that any of them are monolithic, but in fact they have their own agendas. They tend to be impermeable, very, very difficult to know what is really going on, what the long-term agendas are that are at play. And so my research really points to, I would say, the difficulties that certain presidents, ranging from John F. Kennedy to Richard Nixon, have had when they sort of fell afoul of what was perceived as the right course on the part of these bureaucracies. And so that really is my focus, the difficulties that Obama has as an individual without a lot of experience and without really his own necessary heft in these institutions.
So now, what you were very specific, though, also in your article talking about the how the CIA and how the military can, in different administrations, whether it was President Kennedy's administration or President Nixon's administration, and even into that can kind of create an intrigue and create almost having its own intelligence operation inside the White House and the executive branch that has affected policy.
Well, that's right. I mean, this was something new to me. As you know, when I did the research for Family of Secrets, I kept coming upon curious facts, more and more and more facts, and eventually I was forced to sort of reassess what had happened to John F. Kennedy and what had happened to Richard Nixon. I was not somebody who was in the camp of identifying some sort of organized effort against either of them. But when you look at all this evidence, and Family of Secrets has more than 1,000 footnotes and copious government documents and interviews on the record there, I've had to kind of reassess that whole thing and to understand that the same operations that these entities carry out overseas, and as we know, well documented over the years, many of them against democratically elected leaders, in those countries, and nationalists and so forth, they're perfectly capable of doing the same thing in this country. This is a sort of a disturbing concept, and one I think a lot of us would like to believe is not the case, that though they're okay with doing that abroad, they would never countenance such a thing here, and I'm afraid that that's just not the case.
Russ, this is Anthony McCarthy. I'm very curious about, as I read your commentary on Truth Out, I was very curious about what must the Obama administration be thinking. This idea, even if we go back, not just Nixon and JFK, but even Carter, this foreign policy is so important to his ultimate success. I just wonder how much he is willing to stick his finger in to these intelligence agencies and guide them.
Well, we need to be realistic about this. I mean, Barack Obama is a man, and he is a person who just a few years ago was a state senator in Illinois. To expect him to be able to compete on any level, either in terms of his knowledge or his ability to make strategic decisions or to sort of intrigue against all of these different competing factions, it's just unrealistic. It's no surprise that the debate in this country is so incredibly narrow. If you compare the options available to American presidents who come into office to the discussion in say European countries, the entire spectrum is incredibly narrow, and so we're not able to really step back and have those discussions about what are we doing in these places at all, under what conditions and what circumstances were we sold the idea that we need to be in them, and is this a good idea at all? And one of the problems, frankly, is just that the tremendous percentage of the disposable dollars from the federal budget that goes into intelligence, which still has a classified black budget, and into the military, it's so vast. Our economy depends tremendously on the continued expenditure of defense, intelligence, and so-called homeland security dollars. It's just a tremendous, tremendous industry. And I can tell you, as somebody who's been in small business, that the best client you can possibly have is the U.S. government, because there's so many dollars there. And so there's a tremendous amount at stake on Wall Street and our economy in general in this sort of perpetuation of this kind of muscular stance abroad. So there just isn't a whole lot of demand for other options, such as trying to maybe, as some people have advocated, building schools I don't think that's nation building, but building schools in places like Afghanistan. The track record of private organizations that have done that is that you can build, as Nick Kristof pointed out in the New York Times, you can build 20 schools for the price of one GI over there and for a year. And the Taliban does not destroy those schools because they're basically built by the local communities. That kind of rational way of winning friends and stabilizing the country is not really even in play at all.
Sam, let me bring you into this and let you comment on what you thought about what you read and what you've heard.
Well, I suspect that we probably agree on a great many things. I mean, the fact that we overestimate the power of the president coming in and grossly underestimate the power of bureaucracies in Washington to frustrate the will of the president, to drive their own agenda, all of that, I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, that's absolutely true. And it is true that certainly since the Second World War, we have evolved a very large national security state. I am rather skeptical, I guess would be the right word, of the extent to which there are organizations or agencies really sort of actively penetrating or running sources in other parts of the government. Then again, this is Washington. After all, Watergate did happen, and some wacky things have happened along the way. But I don't really think that that's primarily what we're talking about most of the time. I don't think we're really talking about a conspiracy where we have a group of individuals at the top and they're taking specific concrete actions. I think in a lot of ways it's much more dangerous than that. You have this alliance of or this alignment of agencies and money and huge corporations. And it's sort of in everybody's mutual interest to keep this going.
Now, go finish what you're saying.
Well, I don't think, and it certainly does affect how we approach problems. For instance, we right now are having a huge debate about Afghanistan, and it's not an easy debate. And what our choice should be to proceed is a very, very difficult one. But it seems to me that very quickly we have hit on on a very narrow focus on conventional military means for pursuing that conflict. I'm not sure how we got to that conclusion other than the fact that the defense establishment has a huge amount of influence, which is not to say that they love to have a war in Afghanistan, but it's just it's what they do, and there's a lot of money in it, and there's just a lot of people focused on it.
This is interesting. I'd like to hear all of you comment on this. I mean, I think because I was thinking about this as I was reading your article, Russ Baker. I mean, is it a question really that we're looking at of kind of conspiracies with intelligence forces and others trying to stop and take over things or create situations, or is it more what Sam Faddis was alluding to at this moment, that what we see, whether it's that or whether you see whether it's the healthcare bill in Congress or anything else that's going on, that it's this collusion of business, large corporate businesses, defense establishment, intelligence agencies, they all feed on one another because they want the budgets to build their industries, they want the budgets, they want the healthcare bill to take care of private insurance agencies and not really care about creating a public option, or that really is the problem more than looking at kind of the conspiratorial nature of what might have happened or not. Russ Baker?
Well, first of all, I just don't like the word conspiracy. I mean, the fact is it's a category of crime for which people are prosecuted all the time. It's a bunch of people cooperating in some sort of illegal activity, but it has an unfortunate pejorative interpretation. But let me say this. I think that it's both. I agree with Mr. Faddis entirely. However, I'm speaking from my own actual investigative research for Family of Secrets. And let me give you just an example.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's hand was forced to some extent by the unauthorized release to the Washington Post of General McChrystal's assessment his evaluation, supposedly confidential, that it might take 40,000 more troops. Now, this was published by Bob Woodward in the Washington Post, and that's very interesting to me because, as I document in Family of Secrets, 30 years ago, it was Bob Woodward who came right out of top secret work for the Navy, gets bootstrapped into the Washington Post, although he's a cub reporter. Very high-level people are urging people at the highest levels of the Post to hire this guy, and what he does is he immediately goes after Richard Nixon, who was at loggerheads with the CIA and the Pentagon over his own initiatives that they were not happy with. And so here's the same guy again being able to influence this thing. I mean, he's just a conduit, of course, but they're forcing Obama's hand just as they were attempting to force Richard Nixon's hand. So I don't know. I would say it's a conspiracy. It's like Mr. Faddis said. I mean, it's these entities, and it's just the way that things work, but it doesn't make it any less troubling.
Is that how things work? From your history, Sam Faddis?
You know, usually what happens is when we're talking about something like this, I think about operations I was involved in, and I wish they worked that well. I wish that's usually where I end up. I mean, again, I can't speak to the specific facts of every case. I think that Woodward has demonstrated that he's obviously got connections, and he's got pull, and he's got ways to get a hold of things. But I'm skeptical. Again, I'm reusing the same word that somebody manipulated him or used him. I think after 30 years, he's got a lot of contacts.
But I respect that. I'd like to send you my book and then see what you think. As a reporter, I don't go in. I'm very, very careful about this stuff. When people ask me to prognosticate or what's my opinion on anything, I always say I don't know, and I don't know until I collect enough facts. And those are just facts about Mr. Woodward's past and his present, and the central question of who is able to provide this material, because obviously, they're violating the law and providing this material to him, and he's perfectly comfortable publishing it. So, you know, those kinds of deeper stratagems are important to look at. As far as the CIA goes, I mean, certainly that's true. I mean, Tim Weiner's book made the point about all the screw-ups by the agency, but I don't think that's entirely fair either. I think that the CIA, like any institution, has successes and failures, and I'm talking about the successes.
You say something, Anthony?
Well, Mark, I was very curious to get your take on things like when we observe here from this radio studio or wherever, even Russ Baker and his incredible investigative work, I'm always curious about how we can release to the public some damning information, like on a group like Blackwater. And it seems so clear that there are violations and we have to go in another direction and there'll be a congressional hearing. And then everyone comes in and there's a mea culpa. And then, but Blackwater is sent right back. And I wonder sometimes about those relationships and why Congress can't make a clear severing and distinction. This cannot happen, and we cannot use these individuals or these companies, but then they continue. And that's why when I was listening to Sam talk about those relationships, it became real to me. Yeah, there are these deep relationships where everyone, there's these codes of silence. Yep, they're bad boys, but we've started digging this hole and we need somebody to finish digging the hole. And guess what? They're good at digging that hole.
Wait, is there anything from your perspective? And I read Russ's book, and I'd love for Sam to read Russ's book and have some commentary from Sam, because I'm always interested in what Sam thinks about these things. That what we look at here is what you were just describing, that you have all this stuff like Blackwater. You know all their, how they're deeply entrenched in the defense establishment, how they're deeply entrenched in the intelligence establishment, and how they are still have the contracts and making the money they're making and have friends in Congress that and contributing money to campaigns. I mean, there's this nefarious network that seems to always link up with one another and really calls a lot of the shots, is what you're saying. I mean, you, in your article, as we all know, Russ, you talked about when President Eisenhower was leaving
office.
In his last moment, he warned us about the military-industrial complex and that America needs to watch out for the growth of this industry and how it's going to kind of take over huge chunks of our government. And I think that essentially he waited until the very end to say that. He didn't say that during his 8 years, but he said it as he was leaving. And I think, that, again, how do you address that? I mean, how do you begin to take that on? I mean, you can write about it, Russ, you know, and it gets out there, but maybe some people wrestle with it. But how do you address that? I mean, because that is the reality we face.
I mean, I think one of the problems is the way that we look at these things in the permissible conversation. I know, as a journalist striving to maintain mainstream credentials while going into these very sensitive areas, it's incredibly difficult. People constantly warn you, don't go into that, don't touch that, they're going to label you, you know, you're going to have a problem. But there is what they call in Turkey the deep politics factor here, and that is to go much deeper in understanding how all these things come about. Now, Mr. Faddis was talking about that with regard to financial interest, which I think is behind all of this, and it's not any secret. You know, you're rich and you're powerful and you want to maintain that, and you're able to do that. Now, as far as something like Blackwater, we tend to look at these things sort of in isolation. We criticize this company and then we ask, why does the government continue with them? Well, I'm not sure that's the right question. My question would be, what really is Blackwater and who really created it? And I don't see enough explanation of that. I think that a lot of these outfits are actually created from within the government. This really gets so deep. I mean, Mr. Faddis can talk much more about this, the creation of entities that are supposedly independent. I mean, the CIA and other government organizations do this as a matter of course on a daily basis. And so, you know, of course, and then members of Congress either don't know the real story about this or they're sworn to secrecy if they're on an oversight committee. And so the whole thing, you know, remains a sort of circular system we can't break into and change.
Sam, I mean, your years of experience. I mean, you were one of the guys on the ground that we always hear about working for the CIA, doing the work you do. I mean, when you know those things went on that Russ is talking about, so how do you define how you see those relationships working?
Well, it's certainly true that intelligence organizations do create commercial entities as part of intelligence work, and there's a pretty severe limit on how far we can go down the road talking about that. But clearly that's true, and that's no secret, and that's not something that's unique to the Central Intelligence Agency. Organizations like Blackwater are not – Blackwater is not an example of the kind of organization that I was talking about. What I think Blackwater is an example of is what happens with the kind of factors at play that I was discussing earlier. So what you get are a bunch of guys who are prior military who form this organization. And then they bring in, as this organization grows and expands, they continue to bring in former military guys. And I don't just mean the shooters that they hire, the former Marine E5 who was downrange. They hire senior people and they bring them in, whether they're intelligence people or defense people. So these people one day are working for the United States, for the U.S. government, and now they're working for Blackwater. It could be any of these other organizations like this. And their friends are still working inside the government, and they have those contacts. And by the way, their friends still want to get jobs when they retire. And what you have is effectively, you know, the way you might have thought of Pittsburgh once as a town which is owned by the steel industry. You know, on some level, you might say that you have Washington. You could think of it as owned by these kinds of interests. Everybody's scratching everybody's back. It's not like there's some guy at the top pulling the strings.
So if – did I cut you off anything? I mean, so if if you follow this logically out for a moment, I mean, it – and it is true. I mean, different towns are controlled by local industries that are often controlled by the conglomerates, which is Bethlehem Steel and Baltimore, Johns Hopkins Hospital now, and the rest. But when it comes to Blackwater and places like that, one of the things that that Ed Burns and David Simon said to me offhanded when they were shooting the movie Generation Kill about Iraq, and the guys that they had on their advisory team who were Iraq veterans, he said, and Ed, who served in Nam, said, "I've never met soldiers like this. I mean, they threw us out in the field, and we were in the mud, and we did what we could to survive, and went behind enemy lines, did whatever we did. But these guys have more skills than I've seen anybody have ever." And the fear that they had, and other people talked about from that small group, was you go to work for Blackwater, and all these parts of our defense in this country, the armed services used to do, parts of what the intelligence world used to do, is now being farmed out and contracted out to private industry. That's where the danger lies, I think, in the growth of an industry like this, with those contacts in Washington that can do things and seem to be under the radar and not be seen. That's the kind of stuff, when I read Russ Baker's book, begins to make me nervous. Russ.
You know, when I was in from 2002 to 2004, I lived in the former Yugoslavia. I was based in Belgrade, Serbia, and I traveled extensively throughout those countries. And I remember going to Tuzla and going to the American base there, Tuzla in Bosnia, and being just absolutely flabbergasted that the entire security operation for the base had been contracted out to KBR, Brown and Root Halliburton. And I thought, now why would you use outside people to guard a base full of people who themselves are supposed to be, providing security? It was just flabbergasting to me. And one thing I must say is that the kind of people who go to work for outfits like that, they are not there. Certainly very, very skilled at the technical aspects of their job, but the mindset is a problem. And personally, I'm much more comfortable to some extent with people who are not that hardened and not that deeply inculcated in the values of the mercenary world, the regular day-to-day soldiers, because those people, I think, at least haven't entirely had the humanity beaten out of them, and some of them are able to build bridges with the local population.
Sam, I want to ask you, because I think a lot of time, our listeners are probably sitting there and their eyes are probably like saucers as we talk about these types of things, but there is this sense, there's this fear that permeated our country during the second Bush term. There was, people were just so afraid, and we were watching for the what were they called, Mark? The blue code red, the code orange, and we really followed those every day. And so I think it does. I think there is a certain amount of, and I could be wrong, Russ probably will tell me I'm wrong, there's a certain amount of our population that hopes that these kinds of relationships are going on, that these kinds of things are happening, because they think that the more layers on top of this, the safer we are in this country.
Well, look, I think it is undoubtedly true that what we have successfully done is we have constructed, probably, as people typically say, the most powerful and most effective military apparatus in the history of the planet. And so the good news is that it has a pretty good capability to defend us. It obviously comes with dangers as well. And there's, since we're talking about this confluence or this intersection of money and all of this. There is obviously also the danger, and it's more than a danger. We see it all the time, where so you want that money, so you need to keep magnifying threats and you need to create threats. And also, even when the threat is real, it pays to come up with a solution that costs a lot of money. It doesn't pay to come up with a practical, straightforward, simple, and cheap solution. It pays to come up with something that's going to require several billion dollars and a number of years of R&D. And you know, one of the projects I just finished working on, which is related to Homeland Security, I looked into that quite a bit. You know, if you just want to go around and put in place very simple defenses to protect chemical plants in the country, you may or may not get any interest. If you want Homeland Security to just give you a couple of billion dollars and develop all sorts of new sensors and detectors, that's, you can probably get that. So, you know, at the end of the day, then you're left, okay, we clearly have an effective military apparatus, undoubtedly, unparalleled on the face of the planet. Is really all of the money we're spending going for what is necessary? And again, you know, then when this question is of what decisions are being made by all of these various entities, and are they really making the decisions, these government entities now, because they're in the best interest of the country, or are they making it because their buddy who's at Blackwater or wherever is going to make a lot of money off of this and hire them next year?
Now, Russ Baker, before we go to our break, when you talked about President Obama doing something similar to what President Clinton did, which was to steer clear of these establishments so he can take care of other things. I mean, how does that portend for this presidency where we're going?
Well, it's deeply disturbing because, first of all, we ought to be able to, in a vigorous democracy, we ought to be able to speak constructively and candidly about any entity, public or private, and the military and, to some extent, these other apparatuses are almost sort of sacrosanct. You know, we can't, a big percentage of this population has been taught that it is somehow dangerous to our own defense to even discuss how effective and how proper the activities of these entities are, and the president has to follow that. If you look at Obama, one of the first things he did was he traveled to CIA headquarters to sort of give them a pep talk and reassure them that he was not going to be a problem for them. He did similar things with the military. I mean, honestly, they ought to be doing that with the Department of Energy and the Department of Education. There ought to be a consistent standard there, because there are big problems with the mission and the viewpoint to some extent in all of these places.
So, let me ask you this, before we go to this break, is this the beginning of the work? You said you were going to, when we talked last year, we were going to start looking at power in the Obama administration. Are you starting to work on that?
I am. I mean, I try to be a nonpartisan and non-ideological and look at the same issues irrespective of who is in power.
I look forward to that work unfolding over the next couple of years and bringing you on chapter by chapter.
Okay.
Russ Baker, thanks so much. Russ Baker, investigative journalist, author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. His latest piece was in Truth Out, called What Obama is Up Against. It was out Monday, November 2nd, and you can see that link on our website to Truth Out. We'll be right back with Sam Faddis, and be right back with Anthony McCarthy. We're going to be joined by David Riggs talking about the post-traumatic stress, what happened in Fort Hood, and talk a little bit, look at Sam Faddis's chapter in the book he has yet to be published about our dangers in domestic security. And what he wrote about in his first chapter in that book that will be out next year is just what happened in Fort Hood. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We're joined in studio by Anthony McCarthy, of course. It's Monday, which means he's here to co-host and bring his intelligence to the airwaves, help us get through these Mondays. Sam Faddis is still with us, retired CIA operations officer, author of Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. And as we look at what's been going on at Fort Hood, I thought we'd want to spend a few minutes, as we would do over the course of these next several months and have done for the last several years, talking about what some of the real issues are underlying Fort Hood, not about why Major Hassan committed the act he allegedly committed, whether or not, nobody knows why he committed it yet, they're still under investigation, but the unseen story, it seems to me, about all of this, or the suicides and attempted suicides going on at Fort Hood and in our military, or the stories of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is so severe and so intense among returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq in those wars, people who have done 2, 3, 4, 5 tours. We talked about this last week when we were talking about Vietnam. When you were sent over to Nam, you did 13 months and you were home unless you re-upped, and you still suffered mightily from seeing what you saw. We're talking about men and women in the military reserve and in the National Guard and the regular army, a much smaller group, having to go back over and over again, and what stresses those causing. And that's going to be the story in coming years that we're going to see. So we've asked it to – we want to explore that a little bit more again this hour. We're joined on air right now by Executive Director of the Center for Deployment Psychology, who serves on the Dissemination Task Force on the International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies, David Riggs. David, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Is there a PhD or MD we should know about on that name?
It's a PhD.
Okay.
I'm a clinical psychologist, by the way.
Gotcha. So I didn't want to give you titles you didn't deserve. I didn't want to take away the ones you do deserve.
Certainly.
Talk a bit about what you think we are facing here in the years to come. Everything we've read and seen is that close to 700,000 of our returning veterans could be suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, and it could be pretty severe in this group, and then we've seen suicides on a level in our armed forces we have not seen before.
Well, I think, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. As you opened the segment, you talked about how the way we're fighting these wars is different than the way we've fought wars previously, and men and women are going back 2, 3, 4, sometimes even more times into a combat situation. And so partly I want to say we really don't know exactly what to expect as this plays out in the future, because we haven't done it this way before.
Mm-hmm.
What we do know from history, as well as from some of the work that's being done now to try and understand the stress that our troops are under, is that seeing more bad stuff isn't particularly good for you psychologically. And so having people go back in multiple times or have extended time in combat is going to make it more difficult for them to come back and adjust without having problems like post-traumatic stress or depression or other issues. And it's not simply about the combat experience and the stress associated with that. Having these kinds of multiple deployments also puts extreme stress on families and the support system that our service members have. So we're also seeing difficulties in families and the stress that's placed on them. So when folks do come back, it's harder to adjust back in and reintegrate into the families.
I'm very curious. This is Anthony McCarthy. I'm very curious about some of the research that we were doing in preparation for this show, to see that there was a lot of work trying to be preventative. A lot of officers reaching out to their soldiers and networking with each other, watching each other, looking for signs of any kind of stressor, whether they're back here or if they're in Afghanistan or Iraq or any of our other deployments. It seems like they're doing things differently than at least out in front than they did in previous wars. We've been in these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq for some time now.
And I think that's true. And right from the very beginning, there were attempts made to understand what was happening when troops were coming back and to evaluate if they were having problems. What we're seeing over time as these wars have extended is a recognition, I think, that if we're going to place people into combat situations, if we're going to have soldiers and Marines and airmen and seamen going out there doing this work, we have to expect that some portion of them will come back struggling what they've seen or what they experienced in one way or another. But there probably are things that we can do to mitigate against that. We probably can't prevent 100% of it, but we can certainly work to catch it early if there are problems and try and intervene early. And what we're trying to do now is think about what is there that can be built into both training and kind of the mindset of our military personnel that will help to reduce the impact. And just as an example, there are data that suggest fairly strongly that things like unit cohesion and strong leadership will help to mitigate against some of the psychological effects of combat. And so, you know, if we can emphasize those things that are already worked on as part of military training, then we may be able to help some people come back without those kinds of psychological injuries that they might otherwise have.
David, do you treat people?
I don't personally at this point treat people. I have in the past. I've treated both veterans from Vietnam and other wars, as well as civilian survivors of trauma who struggle with PTSD.
But I wonder what it means, I mean, for the future of where the military is going and where we're going as a nation, when you have a small cohort of men and women who are fighting all the battles, having to return over and over and over again to the battlefield. And we're talking about these huge numbers of people, higher percentages than ever before, who are going to come back with post-traumatic stress disorder and other trauma. That this can have a real effect on the military, and on what can happen, and it can have a. I mean, you know, you go to, I mean, the fact that suicides just are up, that what happened to Fort Hood may or may not be connected. We have no idea at this moment, but clearly there's something is going on here that I think could affect our long term effectiveness militarily and our long term effectiveness as a society, given that this isolated group of people are in a small military facing this kind of stress and this kind of trauma coming back.
Well, I think I don't disagree with your premise. There are a couple of things you said that I want to comment on. One is, I'm not sure that we know at this point that the rates of PTSD and other problems are going to be higher in this war than in previous wars. I just don't think we know enough yet to know if that's true. There are going to be people coming back with problems. There already are, and I don't want to minimize those. But I don't think we need to assume that it's going to be greater than in previous wars, because in part because people have been out in front trying to do things to help. The other piece is to recognize that the experience of deployment and the experience of being in combat, doesn't mean that you will have problems. There are a good number of folks who deploy and return successfully and reintegrate into families and society and communities and do just fine. But the other piece is that some of the issues, some of the things that have come up and made headlines, for example, the suicides and the rate of suicides has been increasing in the military. But we need to recognize that a good portion of those individuals who elect to commit suicide or who attempt to commit suicide aren't doing so in response to having been deployed, because they haven't been deployed previously.
I want to ask Sam Faddis about this idea, and I know I can't ask you, I guess, to comment on the specific case or what's going on at Fort Hood, but I was watching an interview with the accused, his sister, and she talked about the fact that he was panicked, that he was terrified that he was going to be deployed. And I don't think, you know, and of course I'm not helping anybody make any excuses for horrific behavior. But I wonder about the longevity of these wars, these encounters we're involved in, and people in our own bases here in our own country who are panicked about being deployed in the next step, the longer this goes on. And of course, we've all heard on television and radio the idea that he was hoping that Barack Obama would change the policy in enough time that he would not have to be deployed. And now that's not making an excuse, but what about that? And I know that you watch these things, you understand these things. His family said, look, he was panicked. And not that they're making an excuse, but I'm afraid there are other people in our own bases here in this country who are just terrified of the next step.
Well, obviously, I don't know anything specifically yeah. about him either, mm-hmm. but you know, this is a huge thing. This is not just like you have a job and now you go do your job overseas for a little while and now you come home. I mean, separation even in that case is bad enough. I mean, you're going somewhere, and whether you're coming back or whether you're not coming back is problematic, and especially guys that are going somewhere where they're going to be shot at. And I don't know any of the details of his assignment, but you know, people are going to die. You're not going to go there and everybody's going to come home and it's going to be a good day. People die, people get wounded, people get blown up, people get maimed. You come back, you go back again a year later, 15 months later, you know. I remember when I went into Iraq, the special forces guys that went along with us. At that point, U.S. Army military policy was there was 180 days maximum on the amount of time they would send those guys into a combat situation. That was the initial timetable we worked on. Didn't work out that way. They just left us there. But that gives you an that gives you an idea of, you know, be careful of the things they tell you when you go downrange as opposed to what they tell you after you're there and you can't do anything about it. But anyway, you know, that was standard policy. That's for special forces. That's for people who are senior and seasoned and an elite group and been through all sorts of selection process. 180 days, you need to come out, and we'll rotate somebody else in because you're going to be crispy.
And finally, I guess that's what I was looking for the stats. I didn't have them here, but the numbers I've been reading are we're talking about 600,000 to 700,000 men and women coming back with post-traumatic stress, and we're talking about among regular civilians who are part of the military, National Guardsmen and reservists who have not experienced this, the numbers are even higher. I mean the percentages are going to be huge, and that they are, but they're suffering. That's why I'm saying that even though you said there's nothing concrete they can say that said there's going to be more, but all the speculation I've been reading in the reports, he said it's going to be much larger for these men and women coming back, and especially in our civilian areas where people are coming back who don't always have the same even have the same access to care that a full time service person does.
And I think that latter statement is quite true, and that we're relying much more on our guardsmen and reservists in these wars than we have previously, and they do return home where they may be one of two or three from their community, if that, who deployed, and so there's a sense of a loss of connectedness to the unit they deployed with, and all those things are going to add stress. There's also just some inherent difficulty in transitioning back to a very different lifestyle than they experienced while they were deployed that can create problems. One of the things that our center was set up to try and do was to educate mental health providers out in the community, civilian providers who may be more likely to be working with guardsmen or reservists than the folks there in the military treatment facilities, just because they're out in small town Iowa or Mississippi or wherever it might happen to be. So we're trying to get some awareness out to them, not only of the post-traumatic stress types of responses that folks might have, but just a general awareness about the military and the culture that goes along with serving in the military and what that means. Because sometimes that can seem very foreign to some of our civilian providers.
David Riggs, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate you being part of this program. I look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
David Riggs, Executive Director of the Center for Deployment Psychology. Number is 410-319-8888. Let's get a phone call in. And Jay, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was a veteran for 10 years, and I served during the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a brother who is in the military now for 17 years. And my concern is that the culture of the military, as proud, you know, as most servicemen are, servicemen and women. I think the culture sets up a tricky balance for service members to be forthright in disclosing whether they're suffering from some form of PTSD. My brother did 2 tours in Iraq, and he couldn't sleep for months and was afraid to go to medical and disclose that because he didn't want to be labeled. He'd been in the military at that point 15 years. Mm. You know, he was a good soldier, and he didn't even know how to deal with that himself. You know, and I have shipmates who are still in the military police who just deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq. And because of what the culture has taught us, they don't always feel comfortable sharing that to a clinician. But they'll have those discussions with each other. They'll talk about some of the trauma even. And I think that has an impact on other service members as well who haven't deployed, who might be stressed about it, who worry about it. I know for the 2 years that my brother was deployed, I couldn't sleep easily, you know? Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine, you know, what those service men and women go through when they do their duty and they have these side effects of doing that duty and they don't really know how to categorize it, or they're too proud, or they're afraid that they might be labeled and kicked out. You know, I think that is a big thing that has been underestimated and unchecked in the military, and I think we're going to suffer greatly because of it with these 2 wars we're fighting.
And that's what I'm fearful of too, which is why I want to follow this so closely. And I think, Jay, what you're saying is something that is becoming clear and clear to many people. It's always happened in the military, but even now that we have, since Vietnam, accepted post-traumatic stress disorder as a reality and that people can be treated for it, people are afraid to say it, especially in this army, in this military, because this is a military made up of men and women who are staying in for a longer period of time in the armed service. So they're afraid to say, okay, I'm feeling whatever it is coming out of my tour, that it's going to affect promotions, it's going to affect your ability to maneuver in the services, and how people are going to look at you. And it's that's what you're saying, Jay, I think is the real danger here, because this is a different military.
Absolutely.
You know, because it's women like you and men like your brother who decide to go in and stay for a while. This is a different military.
Absolutely. Thanks for taking my
call. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Jay.
Because 1968, you were drafted, you got in, and get me out. So, Sam, I want to ask you a question. One of the things, when we go back to Fort Hood, and I know you don't know the specifics of it, and you wouldn't talk about that, but since you don't know it, but you have thought about the dangers inherent that America faces in terms of homeland security, and you're writing a book about it now. And one of the chapters in your book that you're writing paints a scenario similar to what happened in Fort Hood. Talk a bit about that.
Right, and this is one of those situations where I would much rather be wrong and have the people still be alive than be proved correct. But the book, which is actually done and will be out end of February, beginning of March, Willful Neglect, which is on Homeland Security, the first chapter talks about military bases. And in fact, it was my son is a Marine, and it was the experience of attending his graduation at Parris Island, and as an operative sitting there in the bleachers and looking around and watching this graduation ceremony and thinking, you've got to be kidding me. There's no meaningful security of any kind here. This is just wide open, and we're, whatever, 7 years at that point into this war on terror, if we still use that phrase. And it stunned me. And so then that's kind of what led me into doing the book as a whole. But the whole first chapter is basically an examination of going to different military installations and taking a look at them. And I think people have an assumption of security. You hear this phrase like hardened security, whatever that means. And not true. I mean, you know, just amazingly enough, all these years after 9/11, still somehow this assumption that nothing's going to happen here.
It's amazing. I was just listening to you describe that. I was thinking, to be able to kind of sometimes see the world through another human being's eyes. I'm seeing the world we can't see through your eyes, but seeing through your eyes as someone who looks around and can see all the points where there are holes in security and knowing what could happen. That must have been A, frightening and worrying, as you were saying, watching your son graduate at Paris Island before he shipped out to Iraq. But B, so what does it mean about what things have to be done? You alluded earlier to, we have all these expensive solutions. But my guess is you're going to say is the solutions we have to dealing with some of the security questions that we need to address in America are not expensive. They're just clear-headed and we're not doing them.
That's exactly what I was saying. I mean, the basic step, first step, most critical step is we just flip the mental switch and stop with the assumption already that it can't happen here. I mean, this seems to me that we apparently have to repeat this endlessly. I don't know why. This is Pearl Harbor, or the next day it was the Philippines, and you know, then it was 9/11. And sometimes I wonder why we have an intelligence apparatus, because we apparently only defend against the attacks that have already occurred. So we could just wait until we get hit and then create a defense to that one, and we just, because that's effectively the system it seems like we use. I'm being a little facetious, obviously, but sometimes you wonder. So the first switch, the first matter is just psychological. I mean, look, this is Paris Island. We're 8 years into the war. This is the United States Marine Corps. I have no doubt that I don't need to go to Paris Island and instruct the guys who are in charge of physical security on how to secure a base. They know everything there is to know about that. These guys have there are probably people there that have been four times downrange, like we're talking about. So they know how to secure against the enemy, and they have done it in combat. But for some reason, somehow, we now pretend that the United States is off limits. It's especially weird since this war, if you accept the premise that this war started on 9/11, it started here. So I don't know how we decided that there'll be no attacks.
I'm fascinated. I was watching the press conference of the gentleman. I can't remember if he was the commander or who. But one of the and how naive we as journalists can be, because one of the first questions he was asked, if you watch that press conference, was, are you doing anything different with security? And he began to say, well, you know, we really beefed up and we were really strident and stringent on how we were policing this base. And then we kind of let things go and we kind of let our guard down. And now you're going to start seeing things in place again. But I was wondering to myself as he was speaking, well, who are you protecting the base from? I mean, you're talking about people coming from the outside in, but this happened from the inside out. And so I didn't understand his answer, and I didn't understand the journalist asking the question. It's very troubling, very frightening to me.
Right. I don't have any facts about this case that other people who aren't, you know, staying informed and watching the television mm-hmm. or reading the newspapers have. You know, my personal prejudice, personal opinion, that's all it is that this is an act of domestic terrorism. And I think if it had happened abroad in Pakistan, a similar incident, we wouldn't really be having all this discussion about the guys. Mental makeup. And I don't think that makes it a matter of Islam any more than some Christian fundamentalist killing somebody over some issue of faith, abortion, or so forth, makes it an issue of religion. It's not. But I agree with you. We're assuming it is an act of terrorism in any event. You're fighting against an enemy that is constantly going to adapt. They don't have the resources. They don't have the billions of dollars, the giant corporations, all this stuff we were just talking about. They have no choice but to evolve. If all you're doing is trying to stop what they did the last time, it's a waste of time. I mean,
as somebody that talks about security, I was taking an Amtrak train, and my 12-year-old security agent, my youngest daughter, looked out the window as we stopped in Newark, and she went, "Dad, when we go to the airport, they check our bags and everything else. We're sitting here in this train station. Somebody could do anything they wanted to us right here, couldn't they?" That was come out of a 12-year-old just looking at the situation. We're not thinking clearly, it seems to me, about where we need to put the emphasis. I still talk to people and we maybe do a show about this soon, is about the harbor. The harbor is extremely vulnerable here. Every harbor. We're not talking about harbor security at all around the country. The lots of places are just wide open.
Absolutely. Agree completely.
I guess that's a break we're taking. I hear the music in my ears. I thought maybe it was Sam was singing to me, but I doubt that. So the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite looks at growing up in the city with a youth issue, featuring stories on child prodigies, the lives of teenagers, arrested adolescents, and how Baltimore can beat poverty by creating children's zones. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com. For a list of drop locations, we'll be right back. Stay with us.